How are you doing? Good. Glad to hear that. It truly is a beautiful day here in San Diego. And God is already blessed on this beautiful Sabbath. You know, I think as we study the book of Hebrews, it's easy for us to lose track of the context of the writing of this book, who it was written to. And the message at times can lose maybe some of its power because maybe we don't understand the background or what was actually happening in that at that time. And so I just want to review again real quickly before we get into chapter 11 here. Remember that this was a time of persecution. The Christian church was very young. And not only was there persecution from outside of the church, but also from the inside. The Christians were being literally slaughtered left and right. They were hiding for their lives, some of them in the catacombs of Rome. They were being fed to the lions in the Colosseum. They were being crucified on crosses by the thousands. So being a Christian wasn't exactly a choice to live a life that was free of suffering and free of persecution. It's at times it's difficult for us because often we see persecution as maybe not having the right job or not driving the right car or not having the house that we really want. Yeah, there's other things. Maybe you've lost your job. Anyways, we tend to look at persecution as something that inconveniences our lives. And most of us are not being threatened by death, by being fed to the lions, first of all. Even though we may feel sometimes that our bosses are lions, but it's just a different time. And the Christians were people who had an incredibly, incredibly deep sense of who they were, as far as they're identifying the group they were identifying with and who they were not identifying with. It was a very clear line. There was not gray and not fuzzy. It was very, very clear. They knew that by choosing to be a Christian, they were choosing that possibly they would be persecuted, but possibly be put to death. Many of them tried to escape the persecution and the death, and that meant that they traveled to distant countries, inconvenienced their lives, changed their jobs, moved their families, all the things that we are told create stress in our lives. So it was not an easy choice. I wonder if today, if we had to make those same choices, would we? Perhaps that's a question we might want to ask ourselves as we study the book of Hebrews. Paul, in trying to contextualize and to make his message relevant to the group that he's writing to, reminds the Christians, many of who were former Jews, well, they were Jews by their as far as their upbringing and their heritage, but now they had chosen to become Christians. He's reminding them of history, of their forefathers, and the faith that their forefathers and mothers had in the living God. And so he's using a vehicle to transfer or transmit a message that almost everyone that was listening or reading his letter would understand, would identify with, and would be able to understand. And so as the last couple of weeks, you know, we've been through the first part of chapter 11. We've talked about Abel and his testimony, his willingness to face death so that he could worship God in the way that God had asked him, required, or requested him to worship. We also have Enoch, who walked with God, a great man of faith, Wish we knew a little bit more about him, but God's decided that we're just going to mention his name, that he walked with God and he was taken. So we have someone who was so totally consumed by his relationship with God that God could absolutely not live without him for another minute and just took him to heaven. Isn't that wonderful? I'll bet we're all jealous, aren't we? And then, of course, moving along, Noah is brought up. Noah was a man who once again had to stand in the face of ridicule and persecution for what he believed and what he was sharing, his testimony. And so he was an example of someone who not only believed in God, had faith in God, was also willing to manifest that faith and show that faith by his actions. And when God asked him to build an ark, even though it didn't make any sense, it wasn't reasonable, it wasn't rational, it wasn't even scientifically correct, why would you build a boat where there was no need for one? He did it anyway. He did it because God asked him to do it. A tremendous working faith. And so now the Apostle Paul has reminded them of these various examples, and we've come, of course, to the example of Abraham. We've studied Abraham's life before. We know that Abraham was a man who lived in a very heathen environment. At that time, it was a place that was known for its worship of so many different gods and the offering of human sacrifices. And so he was asked by God to leave his home. I think most of us could probably identify with that. Probably most of us have left and moved to new environments, new homes, new communities, new churches, you name it. We can somewhat identify with that. There may be one or two that have lived in the same home all their lives, and I'm sorry, no, just kidding. There's something to be said about going through the challenge of moving. My wife was raised in the same town practically all of her childhood. And when she married me, she had no idea what that would be, constant moving and adjusting. And she said a number of times that at first it was very frightening, but now she realizes it was great. So sometimes we don't recognize the blessing. When God asks us to move, he has a reason, he has a purpose. And in Abraham's life, his purpose was to take Abraham out of the influence, the environment that was not spiritually good for him, and take him to a place where God could speak with him, where God could reveal his purpose for Abraham's life. And it didn't just happen in 1 or 2 months or 2 or 3 years. It happened over a period of his entire life. Abraham was asked to move to a land that he knew not. In other words, a foreign land, foreign language, foreign environment, foreign everything, totally. Some of you can identify with that. If you've ever had to make a move to a different country where you didn't know the language and trying to assimilate yourself into that culture, there are many stresses, and it is not easy. I've done it 3 times in my life, and I remember the anxiety, the worry, the feelings of being totally out of your body. You know, people are all talking a different language and they're looking at you and smiling and laughing. You don't know what they're saying, you know. You have no idea what they're talking about. And then slowly, slowly you struggle and you learn the language and it's an interesting experience. This is what Abraham went through. But along with that, along with the changes in his life, he became closer and closer to God. The friendship that they developed over this period was a very close friendship. It was a personal relationship. You see, it'd be easy for us to look at faith and to analyze it and to, you know, dissect it and to theologize about it and philosophize about it. But a faith that we're talking about here, that Paul's talking about in chapter 11, is a faith that is a relationship. It's not a philosophical concept. It's not a theological idea. It's a relationship. The faith is the word that describes that relationship. Of course, people have used many different words to identify or to compare faith with. They say, well, faith is trust. Yes, it is. Faith is hope. Yes, it is. Faith is following God. Yes, it's all of those things. But it has to do within the context of a relationship with God. And so that's why we see every time a person's name is mentioned here in chapter 11, it's always in the context of faith. And of course, I've asked you to add your name to this list. So do it. You know, if you have a pen, just write it on the side there and say, you know, by faith, Glenn. By faith, Ramsey. By faith, Susan. By faith, John. By faith, you see. Because faith is the result of a relationship. And it's a growing relationship. It's day after day. Faithfulness, day after day after day. Okay? We're studying in this chapter names of great people. The list could be much longer. I think that the Apostle Paul selects, very selective in who he puts here in this list, because these are people that were very prominent, well-known. You didn't even have to really be much of an Old Testament Bible student to know the stories behind these names that he selected. And the fact is that we're confronted with the fact here in this list of names that these are just ordinary people, really. There's nothing extremely special about any of them. They've only become prominent and special because they are mentioned as examples for us to follow. But they, in their world, were very normal people. Very everyday people. And yet, they are people who made extraordinary decisions. Because you see, faith is a decision. It's a decision to have and to establish a relationship that is salvific. In other words, it leads to eternal life and salvation. It's the relationship that we have with God that opens the doorway to eternal life through Jesus Christ. Okay? So if these are ordinary people and they've made extraordinary decisions, we need to make sure that we choose the right rut, you might say. I hate to use that word, but the right road to follow. You know, it's one thing to be stuck in a rut. I've been stuck in many ruts in my life. Over in Borneo, we didn't have paved roads, and rainy season, you definitely used four-wheel drive on a regular basis. Our little Toyota Land Cruiser got us through many, many a trip, slipping and sliding in this red clay. But usually, if you found a rut in mud, it was good. Because the rut was there for a reason. There were many other cars that had gone before you, and they had found that rut. And they had made their way very carefully and yet safely to the end of the journey, to the end of the road. In the case of our relationship with God, the choosing to have faith, choosing to trust the path that God has set for us is always a good choice. It's always a good choice. Of course, in the case of Abraham, the choice to follow and to have faith in God, as I mentioned before, it changed his life, but it also changed the life of his family. In fact, it changed the future of the world in many ways. Even today, the struggle goes on. The struggle of those who are God's chosen, God's children, those who have chosen to be his children, those who are faithful to his call, and have a true relationship, a trusting relationship with him. So decisions are important. Every single person that's mentioned here by name is someone who has made a decision, a very clear decision to follow God's leading. In the case of Abraham, in the case of Abel, in the case of Noah and Isaac, because we're on to Isaac now, which is the promised child, we've realized that in times in life that when you have nothing left, when all hangs on that relationship that you have fostered and the relationship that you have decided and chosen to have with God, we realize that when we have nothing, we have everything, because God is everything. You see, philosophizing or theologizing is a head trip. And people get into those head trips. They like to get into arguments about little insignificant theological arguments. I've been in many, many of them, far too many. And in my old age, I'm not interested much in those arguments anymore, or those discussions. I prefer, and I realize that when I can know everything, but if I don't have God in my life, if I don't have a relationship, I don't have anything. I just have a lot of head knowledge. You see? If head knowledge doesn't lead to a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, then it's just a trip. It's a trip that just goes in circles. In fact, most theological arguments I've gotten into are like big circles. You just go around and around and around and around. The same old arguments, the same old discussions. Which is interesting. I've been reading a big, thick book. When I looked at it in the bookstore, I thought, man, do I really want to take it on? Because I prefer shorter ones. I prefer books that are, 200 pages, 250. I can read them real quick and move on to the next one. This one is... even the title is called Petros Romanus. Ooh. I thought, man, is this really something I want to do? I bought it anyway. I was going on a little excursion with my wife and the family, her father, out in a boat, big boat, last week. I thought, I need something to read. I know that there's going to be time where all you see is water, water, water everywhere. So I did, and I got into this book and I started reading, and it is the history of the Christian church, very detailed history. Much of the documents have been borrowed and used from the Vatican, and it's an inside history of the growth and development of the early Christian church that eventually evolved into the Holy Roman Empire, Catholicism as we know it today. And the one thing that I found over and over again is that there's always this struggle within humanity or within religions, the struggle between those who want to take the path of works, the path of legalism, and those who desire from the depths of their hearts to have a faith relationship with God and to follow the gospel. And it was interesting to discover that from the beginning of time, as far as Christianity is concerned, from the beginning of Christianity, there has been this constant tension. Tension is a good thing to have at times because it allows people to discuss and to think about it and pray about it. You don't have somebody just saying, well, you do. You have cults. And cults basically say, do as I say and don't argue with me, you see. Whereas if there's some tension, there's also a good, healthy discussion going on. And I discovered that this tension not only was very prevalent, very real in the early years, the formative years of Christianity. That would include the time of Paul. We had Arianism going around. That is the teaching that there's really only, one God. Jesus was just created by God the Father. And then you also had the Gnostics, who also were struggling with Paul. And then you had the Judaizers. And there were many other factions that were trying to either water down or distract the Christians in the area of their relationship with God. And so there was a point when the early Christian church came to a point where they had to decide to either go with what was popular, what was easy, to go with what was being taught from the religious leaders of that time, And this author points out that that time was probably around in 200, 234, somewhere around there. And Christianity went the route of being popular, of being a powerful political force and a religious force, of dictating to its members what they should believe, what they should follow, and even willing to persecute and kill them if they didn't follow. Well, basically what you have is a definition of a cult. What's interesting is I'm at almost the end of the book, and I just found out that this is still prevalent and is still going on within the Catholic faith, and which I believe is good news. Because as long as there's a discussion going on and people aren't being killed and murdered and persecuted because they disagree with the authorities, there's always hope that somewhere along the way, people will once again return to a faith relationship, a gospel-orientated relationship with Jesus Christ. I think that's true in any faith community. If we take our eyes off of Jesus, when we take our eyes off of His Word, when we take our eyes off the gospel, and we begin to live independently, when we begin to follow our own wisdom, then we're in trouble. When we follow a cultic leader, we're in trouble. And so what's interesting to me is we come back to Hebrews. We're talking here about Abraham and Isaac. And Abraham, of course, is known by the three largest religions in the world as the father of those religions. Incredible. You say, well, how can that be? He's got to be the father of just one, the true religion. Well, you talk to anyone in all three of those groups, and you're going to find out that they all believe it's the true, they are following the true religion. So we need to ask the question here then, what was the truth about Abraham's relationship and Isaac's relationship with God? And so let's take a look here at Hebrews chapter 11. I want to back up just a little bit, and I want to read just beginning with verse 11. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. Now, you want to include in there that Sarah was the mother. Okay. Abraham was the father and Sarah was the mother. So we have a family here who by faith believed that God would keep his promise, and he did. And God, and of course, you know, the story will go on because it's important here that we read this. Verse 12. And so from this one man, and I'm going to say one woman, okay, and he is as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sands on the seashore. Okay, so Paul is reminding them that through Abraham, the descendants of the promise became as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sands on the seashore. You know, if Abraham had somehow come back to life and had looked around there in Jerusalem and in that area, he would have realized that not only did God bless him with a son, Isaac, but he definitely kept his promise that he would become the father of a great nation. What's interesting is if he were to appear today, he would realize that he is also a father of a fighting family. A family that's scrapping with each other. You've got Israel. I think they're still doing it today. And you've got the Arabs, the Arab League, Arab nations, shooting missiles at each other. And this has gone on as long as I've been alive, and I know it's gone on a lot longer than that. And Abraham would be sad to see that, I think. You know, the descendants of Isaac and the descendants of Ishmael still scrapping. I wonder what he would say to them. It'd be interesting to know. But here in this passage, Paul is trying to develop something that I think is important for all of us. And we go on with let's read verse 13 again. And these people were still living by faith. Okay? All these people, that he has mentioned and the ones that we'll continue to study, all of these people were still living by faith when they died. Well, now, doesn't faith kind of have a point where you got it all figured out and you've got the formula and you just kind of cruise? Obviously not. Because faith becomes a lifestyle. A lifestyle. And it's interesting because that's really what Paul is saying. That all these people were still living by faith when they died. My question to you this morning and to myself is, will I still be living by faith when I die? I look out over the congregation, I realize that most of you are very young. And so that's not something you want to think about. Well, it is something you want to think about. Because you don't just instantly develop a relationship like that. A relationship takes time. And through that experience of time, we learn a tremendous amount of information about who God is and who we are. And so it's through that life of faith that we develop ourselves as individuals, and also we develop a healthy relationship and an understanding of who God is. So these people were all living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. Abraham did not see a nation. He, by faith, believed that God would keep his promise. He only had two sons. And later he had some others, but we don't have much mention of them. But we have Ishmael and we have Isaac. Okay? He could not see the promise of a nation, and yet by faith he believed. Okay? They only saw it from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on the earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. Okay, so here we can definitely identify with what Paul is laying out for us. That all of us, like Abraham, are men and women of faith. God has promised us eternal life. God has promised us a place in heaven. Do we see heaven? No. Do we see the evidence of God's Spirit working within the family? Yes. So we can kind of, you know, Abraham had a son or two, so he knew that at least it was the beginning of a nation, a small, but it was a beginning. Same thing is true for us. We can see the evidence. God has promised us. He has blessed us. He has given us a community to live in, a community of believers, a kingdom to live in. Are we in heaven? No. Are we experiencing all of the blessings that heaven will be? A few of them, but most of them we're going to have to wait for, just as Abraham also had to wait. And these people, he's referring to all the list that he's given us so far of God's faithful. These people who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of a country that they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. You see, now he brings it home. A heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Do you see it? Abel's waiting. Enoch's already there. Lucky guy. Noah's waiting. Abraham's waiting. Isaac's waiting. Ishmael, yes. Ishmael, they're waiting. The list goes on. And in identifying with and understanding that these are people that God has called to walk with him, those who he has called to be his children, they are waiting for the fulfillment of the promise. And the fact is, some of us may die before that promise is completely fulfilled. Some will be living, as in Thessalonians, we're told that some will still be alive when the Lord comes and takes us to heaven, and others will have fallen asleep, as my father has, and my uncles, my grandparents. They've fallen asleep in the knowledge and the faith that God is going to take them to heaven. That's good news. That's good news. It doesn't matter what it... This is hard to say, I know, because we live in a reality here, but it doesn't matter what happens to us here on this earth, as long as we are connected, as long as we have that faith relationship with God. If we're connected, it does not matter. And of course, to the Christians of this time, as I said, they were being persecuted, they were being thrown to the lions, they were being crucified. They did not care about the destruction of their bodies because they knew that the very next thing would be the kingdom of heaven. That's a hard one to swallow, true. But it is interesting in this book that I've been reading that talking about some of the martyrs of the early Christian church, such as Justin, and martyr, some of the other martyrs, our early Christian fathers. They definitely had that attitude. They had the attitude that they were only here as for a short time. They were just passing through the life here on this earth, and that the next thing would be the kingdom of heaven. They willingly went, many willingly went to their death because they had a faith so strong, a trust in God that was so strong that it didn't matter. It's hard, I know, today for us to accept that because we live such such comfortable lives. In reality, most of us live fairly comfortably. And as the author of the book mentioned over and over again, that Christianity prospered under persecution. It prospered under persecution. Not only did it prosper under persecution, but it also knew what its priorities were as far as theology was concerned. And I think that's true today. That the church, because it is not challenged, its faith is not challenged, the church tends to, well, let's use the word Laodicean, it falls asleep. It falls asleep, it loses its passion, it loses its joy, it loses its hope, it loses its faith, it loses everything. Now, I don't have the power to bring any persecution on you, so we have no idea what's in store for any of us, except as long as we know Jesus Christ as our personal Savior, as long as we accept Him and follow Him and develop that faith relationship. There's one thing that is certain, absolutely certain, is that we will spend eternity with God in heaven. I look forward to that. I really do. And at times, as I was traveling for several days on this floating little city, I looked around me. I saw a lot of opulence. A lot of opulence. For some reason, people kept coming up to me and asking me if I was Ken. There's this one, I don't know, Ken. Does anybody know Ken? I kept asking him, are you Ken? No. Well, I thought, no, he's not one of the guys on the Duck Dynasty. So, who is this Ken? I wanted to meet this Ken. And then somebody asked me if I was from France, and I said, no. I should have said, oui. But I guess I looked like somebody. You know, we're all on this ship together. We're all on this journey together. And we have time to decide. We have time to decide to follow Christ and to have a faith relationship. There will come a time when time will run out. And I'm not a doomsday prophet. There's plenty of those you can read in the Bible. But I think we do need to wake up. I think we do need to wake up. It's time to wake up. And it's time for us, past time for us, to establish that relationship that brings eternal life through Jesus Christ. And that's what Paul is trying to, He's trying to wake the church up. He's trying to remind them of the past, and it's been said many times that we have nothing to fear except we what? Forget how God has led in the past. Don't forget. That's what Paul's saying. Don't forget how God has led in the past. Keep that alive. Keep that memory alive in your mind, how God has blessed and led you in the past. Because then you'll have the confidence and the assurance for the future. I challenge us as a church. God has richly blessed us here. And along with blessings, sometimes we kind of get a laid-back attitude. We get an attitude that, well, you know, it's always going to be this way and everything's going to be fine. Well, I'm not asking for persecution, but I think it's good for us now to continue to develop that relationship, not just as individuals, but as a church. God's given us ample, ample evidence of His blessing here at Point Loma. I'm not talking about monetary blessings. I'm talking about just the relationships and the people and individuals, watching the growth of individuals here in this church and how the relationship they have developed with God has led to such a blessed life. Let's continue to ask God to lead us individually and collectively. Until that day, He takes us home. And then we will realize fully what He had in store for us.